This is Audible.
Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Hunger of Memory, The Education of Richard Rodriguez, by Richard Rodriguez, narrated by Jonathan Davis. Prologue. Middle Class Pastoral. I have taken Caliban's advice. I have stolen their books. I will have some run of this isle. Once upon a time, I was a socially disadvantaged child, an enchantedly happy child. Mine was a childhood of intense family closeness and extreme public alienation. 30 years later, I write this book as a middle-class American man, assimilated, dark-skinned, to be seen at a Belgravia dinner party or in New York, exotic in a tuxedo. My face is drawn to severe Indian features, which would pass notice on the page of a National Geographic. But at a cocktail party in Bel Air, somebody wonders, have you ever thought of doing any high-fashion modeling? Take this card. In Beverly Hills, will this monster make a man? A lady in a green dress asks, didn't we meet at the Thompson's party last month in Malibu? And what do you do, Mr. Rodriguez? I write. I am a writer. A part-time writer. When I began this book 5 years ago, a fellowship bought me a year of continuous silence in my San Francisco apartment. But the words wouldn't come. The money ran out, so I was forced to take temporary jobs. I have friends who, with a phone call, can find me well-paying work. In past months, I have found myself in New York, in Los Angeles, working with money. Among people with money, and at leisure, a weekend guest in Connecticut at a cocktail party in Bel Air. Perhaps because I have always accidentally been a classmate to children of rich parents, I long ago came to assume my association with their world, came to assume that I could have money if it was money I wanted. But money, big money, has never been the goal of my life. My story is not a version of Sammy Glick's. I work to support my habit of writing. The great luxury of my life is the freedom to sit at this desk. Mr. Rodriguez, the name on the door, the name on my passport, the name I carry from my parents, who are no longer my parents in a cultural sense. This is how I pronounce it. Richard Rodriguez. This is how I hear it most often. The voice through a microphone says, ladies and gentlemen, it is with pleasure that I introduce Mr. Richard Rodriguez. I am invited very often these days to speak about modern education in college auditoriums and in Holiday Inn ballrooms. I go, still feel a calling to act the teacher, though not licensed by the degree. One time my audience is a convention of university administrators. Another time, high school teachers of English. Another time, a women's alumni group. Mr. Rodriguez has written extensively about contemporary education. Several essays. I have argued particularly against two government programs, affirmative action and bilingual education. He is a provocative speaker. I have become notorious among certain leaders of America's ethnic left. I am considered a dupe, an ass, the fool, Tom Brown, the brown Uncle Tom, interpreting the writing on the wall to a bunch of cigar-smoking pharaohs. A dainty white lady at the women's club luncheon approaches the podium after my speech to say, after all, wasn't it a shame that I wasn't able to use my Spanish in school? What a shame! But how dare her lady-fingered pieties extend to my life? There are those in white America who would anoint me to play out for them some drama of ancestral reconciliation. Perhaps because I am marked by indelible color, they easily suppose that I am unchanged by social mobility, that I can claim unbroken ties with my past. The possibility. At a time when many middle-class children and parents grow distant, apart, no longer speak, romantic solutions appeal. But I reject the role. Caliban won't ferry a TV crew back to his island, there to recover his roots. Aztec ruins hold no special interest for me. I do not search Mexican graveyards for ties to unnameable ancestors. I assume I retain certain features of gesture and mood derived from buried lives. I also speak Spanish today and read Garcia Lorca and Garcia Marquez at my leisure. But what consolation can that fact bring against the knowledge that my mother and father have never heard of Garcia Lorca or Garcia Marquez? What preoccupies me is immediate, the separation I endure with my parents in loss. This is what matters to me. The story of the scholarship boy who returns home one summer from college to discover bewildering silence, facing his parents. This is my story, an American story. Consider me, if you choose, a comic victim of two cultures. This is my situation. Writing these pages, surrounded in the room I am in by volumes of Montaigne and Shakespeare and Lawrence. They are mine now. A Mexican woman passes in a black dress. She wears a white apron. She carries a tray of hors d'oeuvres. She must only be asking if there are any I want as she proffers the tray like a wheel of good fortune. I shake my head. No. Does she wonder how I am here, in Bel Air? It is education that has altered my life, carried me far. I write this autobiography as the history of my schooling. To admit the change in my life, I must speak of years as a student, of losses, of gains. I consider my book a kind of pastoral. I write in the tradition of that high, courtly genre. But I am no upper-class pastoral singer. Upper-class pastoral can admit envy for the intimate pleasures of rustic life as an arrogant way of reminding its listeners of their difference, their own public power and civic position. Let's be shepherds. Ah, if only we could. Unlike the upper class, the middle class lives in a public world, lacking great individual power and standing. Middle-class pastoral is therefore a more difficult hymn. There is no grand compensation to the admission of envy of the poor. The middle class rather is tempted by the pastoral impulse to deny its difference from the lower class, even to attempt cheap imitations of lower class life. But I still am a shepherd. I must resist being tempted by this decadent solution to mass public life. It seems to me dangerous because, in trying to imitate the lower class, the middle class blurs the distinction so crucial to social reform. One can no longer easily say what exactly distinguishes the alien poor. I do not write as a modern-day Wordsworth seeking to imitate the intimate speech of the poor. I sing Ariel's song to celebrate the intimate speech my family once freely exchanged. In singing the praise of my lower-class past, I remind myself of my separation from the past, bring memory to silence. I turn to consider the boy I once was in order, finally, to describe the man I am now. I remember what was so grievously lost to define what was necessarily gained. But the New York editor is on the phone and he can't understand. Why do you spend so much time on abstract issues? Nobody's going to remember affirmative action in another 25 years. The strength of this manuscript is in the narrative. You should write your book in stories, not as a series of essays. Let's have more grandma. But no. Here is my most real life. My book is necessarily political in the conventional sense for public issues. Editorials and ballot stubs, petitions and placards, faceless formulations of greater and lesser good by greater and lesser minds, have bisected my life and changed its course. And in some broad sense, my writing is political, because it concerns my movement away from the company of family and into the city. This was my coming of age. I became a man by becoming a public man. This autobiography, moreover, is a book about language. I write about poetry, the new Roman Catholic liturgy, learning to read, writing, political terminology. Language has been the great subject of my life. In college and graduate school, I was registered as an English major. But well before then, from my first day of school, I was a student of language, obsessed by the way it determined my public identity, the way it permits me here to describe myself, writing this manuscript, essays impersonating an autobiography, 6 chapters of sad, fugue-like repetition. Now it exists, a weight in my hand. Let the bookstore clerk puzzle over where it should be placed. Rodriguez, Rodriguez. Probably he will shelve it alongside specimens of that exotic new genre, ethnic literature. Mistaken, the gullible reader will, in sympathy or in anger, take it that I intend to model my life as the typical Hispanic American life. But I write of one life only, my own. If my story is true, I trust it will resonate with significance for other lives. Finally, my history deserves public notice as no more than this, a parable for the life of its reader. Here is the life of a middle-class man. Chapter 1. Aria. 1. I remember to start with that day in Sacramento, a California now nearly 30 years past, when I first entered a classroom, able to understand some 50 stray English words. The third of 4 children, I had been preceded to a neighborhood Roman Catholic school by an older brother and sister. But neither of them had revealed very much about their classroom experiences. Each afternoon they returned as they left in the morning, always together, speaking in Spanish as they climbed the 5 steps of the porch. And their mysterious books, wrapped in shopping bag paper, remained on the table next to the door, closed firmly behind them. An accident of geography sent me to a school where all my classmates were white, many of the children of doctors and lawyers and business executives. All my classmates certainly must have been uneasy on that first day of school, as most children are uneasy, to find themselves apart from their families in the first institution of their lives. But I was astonished. The nun said in a friendly but oddly impersonal voice, "Boys and girls, this is Richard Rodriguez." I heard her sound out, "Richard Rodriguez." It was the first time I had heard anyone name me in English. "Richard," the nun repeated more slowly, writing my name down in her black leather book. Quickly I turned to see my mother's face dissolve in a watery blur behind the pebbled glass door. Many years later, there is something called bilingual education, a scheme proposed in the late 1960s by Hispanic American social activists, later endorsed by a congressional vote. It is a program that seeks to permit non-English-speaking children, many from lower-class homes, to use their family language as the language of school. Such is the goal its supporters announce. I hear them and am forced to say no. It is not possible for a child, any child, ever to use his family's language in school. Not to understand this is to misunderstand the public uses of schooling and to trivialize the nature of intimate life, of family's language. Memory teaches me what I know of these matters, the boy reminds the adult. I was a bilingual child, a certain kind, socially disadvantaged, the son of working-class parents, both Mexican immigrants. In the early years of my boyhood, my parents coped very well in America. My father had steady work. My mother managed at home. They were nobody's victims. Optimism and ambition led them to a house, our home, many blocks from the Mexican south side of town. We lived among gringos, and only a block from the biggest, whitest houses. It never occurred to my parents that they couldn't live wherever they chose. Nor was the Sacramento of the 50s bent on teaching them a contrary lesson. My mother and father were more annoyed than intimidated by those two or three neighbors who tried initially to make us unwelcome. Keep your brats away from my sidewalk. But despite all they achieved, perhaps because they had so much to achieve, any deep feeling of ease, the confidence of belonging in public, was withheld from them both. They regarded the people at work, the faces and crowds, as very distant from us. There were the others, los gringos. That term was interchangeable in their speech with another, even more telling, los americanos. I grew up in a house where the only regular guests were my relations. For one day, enormous families of relatives would visit, and there would be so many people that the noise and the bodies would spill out to the backyard and front porch. Then, for weeks, no one came by. It was usually a salesman who rang the doorbell. Our house stood apart, a gaudy yellow in a row of white bungalows. We were the people with the noisy dog, the people who raised pigeons and chickens. We were the foreigners on the block. A few neighbors smiled and waved. We waved back. But no one in the family knew the names of the old couple who lived next door. Until I was 7 years old, I did not know the names of the kids who lived across the street. In public, my mother and father spoke a hesitant, accented, not always grammatical English. And they would have to strain their bodies tense to catch the sense of what was rapidly said by los gringos. At home, they spoke Spanish. The language of their Mexican past sounded in counterpoint to the English of public society. The words would come quickly, with ease. Conveyed through those sounds was the pleasing, soothing, consoling reminder of being at home. During those years, when I was first conscious of hearing, my mother and father addressed me only in Spanish. In Spanish, I learned to reply. By contrast, English, inglés, rarely heard in the house, was the language I came to associate with gringos. I learned my first words of English overhearing my parents speak to strangers. At 5 years of age, I knew just enough English for my mother to trust me on errands to stores one block away. No more. I was a listening child, careful to hear the very different sounds of Spanish and English. Wide-eyed with hearing, I'd listen to sounds more than words. First, there were English gringo sounds. So many words were still unknown that when the butcher or the lady at the drugstore said something to me, exotic polysyllabic sounds would bloom in the midst of their sentences. Often, the speech of people in public seemed to me very loud, booming with confidence. The man behind the counter would literally ask, "What can I do for you?" But by being so firm and so clear, the sound of his voice said that he was a gringo. He belonged in public society. I would also hear then the high nasal notes of middle-class American speech. The air stirred with sound. Sometimes, even now, when I have been traveling abroad for several weeks, I will hear what I heard as a boy. In hotel lobbies or airports in Turkey or Brazil, Some Americans will pass, and suddenly I will hear it again. The high sound of American voices. For a few seconds I will hear it with pleasure, for it is now the sound of my society, a reminder of home. But inevitably, already on the flight headed for home, the sound fades with repetition. I will be unable to hear it anymore. When I was a boy, things were different. The accent of Los Gringos was never pleasing, nor was it hard to hear. Crowds at Safeway or at bus stops would be noisy with sound, and I would be forced to edge away from the chirping chatter above me. I was unable to hear my own sounds, but I knew very well that I spoke English poorly. My words could not stretch far enough to form complete thoughts, and the words I did speak I didn't know well enough to make into distinct sounds. Listeners would usually lower their heads, better to hear what I was trying to say. But it was one thing for me to speak English with difficulty. It was more troubling for me to hear my parents speak in public. Their high whining vowels and guttural consonants, their sentences that got stuck with a and ah sounds, the confused syntax, the hesitant rhythm of sounds so different from the way gringos spoke. I'd noticed, moreover, that my parents' voices were softer than those of gringos we'd meet. I am tempted now to say that none of this mattered. In adulthood, I am embarrassed by childhood fears, and in a way, it didn't matter very much that my parents could not speak English with ease. Their linguistic difficulties had no serious consequences. My mother and father made themselves understood at the county hospital clinic and at government offices, and yet in another way, it mattered very much. It was unsettling to hear my parents struggle with English. Hearing them, I'd grow nervous. My clutching trust in their protection and power weakened. There were many times, like the night at a brightly lit gasoline station, a blaring white memory, when I stood uneasily hearing my father. He was talking to a teenaged attendant. I do not recall what they were saying, but I cannot forget the sounds my father made as he spoke. At one point, his words slid together to form one word, sounds as confused as the threads of blue and green oil in the puddle next to my shoes. His voice rushed through what he had left to say, and toward the end reached falsetto notes, appealing to his listener's understanding. I looked away to the lights of passing automobiles. I tried not to hear any more. But I heard only too well the calm, easy tones in the attendant's reply. Shortly afterward, walking toward home with my father, I shivered when he put his hand on my shoulder. The very first chance that I got, I evaded his grasp and ran on ahead into the dark, skipping with feigned boyish exuberance. And then there was Spanish. Español, my family's language. Español, the language that seemed to me a private language. I'd hear strangers on the radio and in the Mexican Catholic Church across town speaking in Spanish, but I couldn't really believe that Spanish was a public language like English. Spanish speakers rather seemed related to me, for I sensed that we shared, through our language, the experience of feeling apart from Los Gringos. It was thus a ghetto Spanish that I heard and I spoke. Like those whose lives are bound by a barrio, I was reminded by Spanish of my separateness from los otros, los gringos in power. But more intensely than for most barrio children, because I did not live in a barrio. Spanish seemed to me the language of home. Most days it was only at home that I'd hear it. It became the language of joyful return. A family member would say something to me, and I would feel myself specially recognized. My parents would say something to me, and I would feel embraced by the sounds of their words. Those sounds said, "I am speaking with ease in Spanish. I am addressing you in words I never use with Los Gringos. I recognize you as someone special, close, like no one outside. You belong with us, in the family. Ricardo. At the age of 5, 6, well past the time when most other children no longer easily notice the difference between sounds uttered at home and words spoken in public, I had a different experience. I lived in a world magically compounded by sounds. I remained a child longer than most. I lingered too long, poised at the edge of language, often frightened by the sounds of Los Gringos, delighted by the sounds of Spanish at home. I shared with my family a language that was startlingly different from that used in the great city around us. For me, there were none of the gradations between public and private society so normal to a maturing child. Outside the house was public society. Inside the house was private. Just opening or closing the screen door behind me was an important experience. I'd rarely leave home all alone or without reluctance. Walking down the sidewalk under the canopy of tall trees, I'd warily notice the suddenly silent neighborhood kids who stood warily watching me. Nervously, I'd arrive at the grocery store to hear there the sounds of the gringo foreign to me, reminding me that in this world so big I was a foreigner. But then I'd return. Walking back toward our house, climbing the steps from the sidewalk, when the front door was open in summer, I'd hear voices beyond the screen door talking in Spanish. For a second or two, I'd stay, linger there, listening. Smiling, I'd hear my mother call out, saying in Spanish, words. Is that you, Richard? All the while her sounds would assure me, you are home now, come closer, inside, with us. See, I'd reply. Once more inside the house, I would assume my place in the family. The sounds would dim, grow harder to hear. Once more at home, I would grow less aware of that fact. It required, however, no more than the blurt of the doorbell to alert me to listen to sounds all over again. The house would turn instantly still while my mother went to the door. I'd hear her hard English sounds. I'd wait to hear her voice return to soft-sounding Spanish, which assured me, as surely as did the clicking tongue of the lock on the door, that the stranger was gone. Plainly, it is not healthy to hear such sounds so often. It is not healthy to distinguish public words from private sounds so easily. I remained cloistered by sounds, timid and shy in public, too dependent on voices at home. And yet it needs to be emphasized. I was an extremely happy child at home. I remember many nights when my father would come back from work and I'd hear him call out to my mother in Spanish, sounding relieved. In Spanish, he'd sound light and free notes he never could manage in English. Some nights, I'd jump up just at hearing his voice. With mis hermanos, I would come running into the room where he was with my mother. Our laughing, so deep was the pleasure, became screaming. Like others who know the pain of public alienation, we transformed the knowledge of our public separateness and made it consoling, the reminder of intimacy. Excited, we joined our voices in a celebration of sound. We are speaking now the way we never speak out in public. We are alone, together. Voices sounded, surrounded to tell me. Some nights, no one seemed willing to loosen the hold sounds had on us. At dinner, we invented new words. Ours sounded Spanish, but made sense only to us. We pieced together new words by taking, say, an English verb and giving it Spanish endings. My mother's instructions at bedtime would be lacquered with mock-urgent tones. Or a word like "si" would become in several notes, able to convey added measures of feeling. Tongues explored the edges of words, especially the fat vowels. And we happily sounded that military drum roll, the twirling roar of the Spanish R. Family language. My family sounds. The voices of my parents and sisters and brother. Their voices insisting you belong here. We are family members, related, special to one another. Listen. Voices singing and sighing, rising, straining, then surging, teeming with pleasure that burst syllables into fragments of laughter. At times it seemed there was steady quiet only when, from another room, the rustling whispers of my parents faded, and I moved closer to sleep. 2. Supporters of bilingual education today imply that students like me miss a great deal by not being taught in their family's language. What they seem not to recognize is that, as a socially disadvantaged child, I considered Spanish to be a private language. What I needed to learn in school was that I had the right and the obligation to speak the public language of los gringos. The odd truth is that my first grade classmates could have become bilingual, in the conventional sense of that word, more easily than I. Had they been taught, as upper middle class children are often taught early, a second language like Spanish or French, they could have regarded it simply as that, another public language. In my case, such bilingualism could not have been so quickly achieved. What I did not believe was that I could speak a single public language. Without question, it would have pleased me to hear my teachers address me in Spanish when I entered the classroom. I would have felt much less afraid. I would have trusted them and responded with ease. But I would have delayed, for how long postponed, having to learn the language of public society. I would have evaded, and for how long could I have afforded to delay, learning the great lesson of school, that I had a public identity. Fortunately, my teachers were unsentimental about their responsibility. What they understood was that I needed to speak a public language. So their voices would search me out, asking me questions. Each time I heard them, I'd look up in surprise to see a nun's face frowning at me. I'd mumble, not really meaning to answer. The nun would persist. "Richard, stand up. Don't look at the floor. Speak up. Speak to the entire class, not just to me." But I couldn't believe that the English language was mine to use. In part, I did not want to believe it. I continued to mumble. I resisted the teacher's demands. Did I somehow suspect that once I learned public language, my pleasing family life would be changed? Silent, waiting for the bell to sound, I remained dazed, diffident, afraid. Because I wrongly imagined that English was intrinsically a public language and Spanish an intrinsically private one, I easily noted the difference between classroom language and the language of home. At school, words were directed to a general audience of listeners, boys and girls. Words were meaningfully ordered. And the point was not self-expression alone, but to make oneself understood by many others. The teacher quizzed, "Boys and girls, why do we use that word in this sentence? Could we think of a better word to use there? Would the sentence change its meaning if the words were differently arranged? And wasn't there a better way of saying much the same thing?" I couldn't say. I wouldn't try to say. 3 months, five, half a year passed. Unsmiling, ever watchful, my teachers noted my silence. They began to connect my behavior with the difficult progress my older sister and brother were making. Until one Saturday morning, three nuns arrived at the house to talk to our parents. Stiffly, they sat on the blue living room sofa. From the doorway of another room, spying the visitors, I noted the incongruity. The clash of two worlds, the faces and voices of school, intruding upon the familiar setting of home. I overheard one voice gently wondering, "Do your children speak only Spanish at home, Mrs. Rodriguez?" While another voice added, "That Richard especially seems so timid and shy." That Richard! With great tact, the visitors continued, "Is it possible for you and your husband to encourage your children to practice their English when they are home?" "Of course," my parents complied. What would they not do for their children's well-being? And how could they have questioned the church's authority which those women represented? In an instant, they agreed to give up the language, the sounds, that had revealed and accentuated our family's closeness. The moment after the visitors left, the change was observed. "Ahora, speak to us in English," my mother and father united to tell us. At first it seemed a kind of game. After dinner each night, the family gathered to practice our English. It was still then Inglés, a language foreign to us, so we felt drawn as strangers to it. Laughing, we would try to define words we could not pronounce. We played with strange English sounds, often over-anglicizing our pronunciations. And we filled the smiling gaps of our sentences with familiar Spanish sounds. "But that was cheating," somebody shouted. Everyone laughed. In school, meanwhile, like my brother and sister, I was required to attend a daily tutoring session. I needed a full year of special attention. I also needed my teachers to keep my attention from straying in class by calling out, "Richard," their English voices slowly prying loose my ties to my other name, its three notes, Ricardo. Most of all, I needed to hear my mother and father speak to me in a moment of seriousness in broken, suddenly heartbreaking English. The scene was inevitable. One Saturday morning, I entered the kitchen where my parents were talking in Spanish. I did not realize that they were talking in Spanish, however, until at the moment they saw me, I heard their voices change to speak English. Those gringo sounds they uttered startled me, pushed me away. In that moment of trivial misunderstanding and profound insight, I felt my throat twisted by unsounded grief. I turned quickly and left the room. But I had no place to escape to with Spanish. The spell was broken. My brother and sisters were speaking English in another part of the house. Again and again in the days following, increasingly angry, I was obliged to hear my mother and father, "Speak to us in Inglés. Speak." Only then did I determine to learn classroom English. Weeks after it happened, one day in school, I raised my hand to volunteer an answer. I spoke out in a loud voice, and I did not think it remarkable when the entire class understood. That day, I moved very far from the disadvantaged child I had been only days earlier. The belief, the calming assurance that I belonged in public, had at last taken hold. Shortly after, I stopped hearing the high and loud sounds of los gringos. A more and more confident speaker of English, I didn't trouble to listen to how strangers sounded speaking to me. And there simply were too many English-speaking people in my day for me to hear American accents anymore. Conversations quickened, listening to persons who sounded eccentrically pitched voices. I usually noted their sounds for an initial few seconds before I concentrated on what they were saying. Conversations became contentful, transparent. Hearing someone's tone of voice, angry or questioning or sarcastic or happy or sad, I didn't distinguish it from the words it expressed. Sound and word were thus tightly wedded. At the end of the day, I was often bemused, always relieved to realize how silent, though crowded with words, my day in public had been. The public silence measured and quickened the change in my life. At last, 7 years old, I came to believe what had been technically true since my birth. I was an American citizen. But the special feeling of closeness and home was diminished by then. Gone was the desperate, urgent, intense feeling of being at home. Rare was the experience of feeling myself individualized by family intimates. We remained a loving family, but one greatly changed. No longer so close, no longer bound tight by the pleasing and troubling knowledge of our public separateness. Neither my older brother nor sister rushed home after school anymore. Nor did I. When I arrived home, there would often be neighborhood kids in the house, or the house would be empty of sounds. Following the dramatic Americanization of their children, even my parents grew more publicly confident, especially my mother. She learned the names of all the people on our block, and she decided we needed to have a telephone installed in the house. My father continued to use the word gringo, but it was no longer charged with the old bitterness or distrust. Stripped of any emotional content, the word simply became a name for those Americans not of Hispanic descent. Hearing him sometimes, I wasn't sure if he was pronouncing the Spanish word gringo or saying gringo in English. Matching the silence I started hearing in public was a new quiet at home. The family's quiet was partly due to the fact that, as we children learned more and more English, we shared fewer and fewer words with our parents. Sentences needed to be spoken slowly when a child addressed his mother or father. Often the parent wouldn't understand. The child would need to repeat himself. Still, the parent misunderstood. The young voice, frustrated, would end up saying, "Never mind, the subject was closed." Dinners would be noisy with the clinking of knives and forks against dishes. My mother would smile softly between her remarks. My father at the other end of the table would chew and chew at his food while he stared over the heads of his children. My mother. My father. After English became my primary language, I no longer knew what words to use in addressing my parents. The old Spanish words, those tender accents of sound I had used earlier, mamá and papá, I couldn't use anymore. They would have been too painful reminders of how much had changed in my life. On the other hand, the words I heard neighborhood kids call their parents seemed equally unsatisfactory. Mother and father, ma, papa, pa, dad, pop. How I hated the all-American sound of that last word especially. All these terms I felt were unsuitable, not really terms of address from my parents. As a result, I never used them at home. Whenever I'd speak to my parents, I would try to get their attention with eye contact alone. In public conversations, I'd refer to my parents or my mother and father. My mother and father, for their part, responded differently as their children spoke to them less. She grew restless, seemed troubled and anxious at the scarcity of words exchanged in the house. It was she who would question me about my day when I came home from school. She smiled at small talk. She pried at the edges of my sentences to get me to say something more. What? She'd join conversations she overheard, but her intrusions often stopped her children's talking. By contrast, my father seemed reconciled to the new quiet. Though his English improved, somewhat, he retired into silence. At dinner he spoke very little. One night his children, and even his wife, helplessly giggled at his garbled English pronunciation of the Catholic grace before meals. Thereafter he made his wife recite the prayer at the start of each meal, even on formal occasions, when there were guests in the house. Hers became the public voice of the family. On official business, it was she, not my father, one would usually hear on the phone or in stores, talking to strangers. His children grew so accustomed to his silence that years later they would speak routinely of his shyness. My mother would often try to explain. Both his parents died when he was 8. He was raised by an uncle who treated him like little more than a menial servant. He was never encouraged to speak. He grew up alone. A man of few words. But my father was not shy, I realized, when I'd watch him speaking Spanish with relatives. Using Spanish, he was quickly effusive. Especially when talking with other men, his voice would spark, flicker, flare alive with sounds. In Spanish, he expressed ideas and feelings he rarely revealed in English. With firm Spanish sounds, he conveyed confidence and authority English would never allow him. The silence at home, however, was finally more than a literal silence. Fewer words passed between parent and child, but more profound was the silence that resulted from my inattention to sounds. At about the time I no longer bothered to listen with care to the sounds of English in public, I grew careless about listening to the sounds family members made when they spoke. Most of the time I heard someone speaking at home and didn't distinguish his sounds from the words people uttered in public. I didn't even pay much attention to my parents' accented and ungrammatical speech. at least not at home. Only when I was with them in public would I grow alert to their accents, though, even then, their sounds caused me less and less concern, for I was increasingly confident of my own public identity. I would have been happier about my public success had I not sometimes recalled what it had been like earlier, when my family had conveyed its intimacy through a set of conveniently private sounds. Sometimes in public, hearing a stranger, I'd hark back to my past. A Mexican farm worker approached me downtown to ask directions to somewhere. "Hijito," he said, and his voice summoned deep longing. Another time, standing beside my mother in the visiting room of a Carmelite convent, before the dense screen which rendered the nuns' shadowy figures, I heard several Spanish-speaking nuns, their busy sing-song overlapping voices assure us that yes, yes, we were remembered. All our family was remembered in their prayers. Their voices echoed far away family sounds. Another day, a dark-faced old woman, her hand light on my shoulder, steadied herself against me as she boarded a bus. She murmured something I couldn't quite comprehend. Her Spanish voice came near like the face of a never-before-seen relative in the instant before I was kissed. Her voice, like so many of the Spanish voices I'd hear in public, recalled the golden age of my youth. Hearing Spanish then, I continued to be a careful, if sad, listener to sounds. Hearing a Spanish-speaking family walking behind me, I turned to look. I smiled for an instant, before my glance found the Hispanic-looking faces of strangers in the crowd going by. Today, I hear bilingual educators say that children lose a degree of individuality by becoming assimilated into public society. Bilingual schooling was popularized in the 70s, that decade when middle-class ethnics began to resist the process of assimilation, the American melting pot. But the bilingualists simplistically scorn the value and necessity of assimilation. They do not seem to realize that there are two ways a person is individualized. So they do not realize that while one suffers a diminished sense of private individuality by becoming assimilated into public society, such assimilation makes possible the achievement of public individuality. The bilingualists insist that a student should be reminded of his difference from others in mass society, his heritage. But they equate mere separateness with individuality. The fact is that only in private, with intimates, is separateness from the crowd a prerequisite for individuality. An intimate draws me apart, tells me that I am unique, unlike all others. In public, by contrast, full individuality is achieved, paradoxically, by those who are able to consider themselves members of the crowd. Thus it happened for me. Only when I was able to think of myself as an American, no longer an alien in gringo society, could I seek the rights and opportunities necessary for full public individuality. The social and political advantages I enjoy as a man result from the day that I came to believe that my name indeed is Richard Rodriguez. It is true that my public society today is often impersonal. My public society is usually mass society. Yet despite the anonymity of the crowd and despite the fact that the individuality I achieve in public is often tenuous, because it depends on my being one in a crowd, I celebrate the day I acquired my new name. Those middle-class ethnics who scorn assimilation seem to me filled with decadent self-pity, obsessed by the burden of public life. Dangerously, they romanticize public separateness, and they trivialize the dilemma of the socially disadvantaged. My awkward childhood does not prove the necessity of bilingual education. My story discloses instead an essential myth of childhood, inevitable pain. If I rehearse here the changes in my private life after my Americanization, it is finally to emphasize the public gain. The loss implies the gain. The house I returned to each afternoon was quiet. Intimate sounds no longer rushed to the door to greet me. There were other noises inside. The telephone rang. Neighborhood kids ran past the door of the bedroom where I was reading my school books, covered with shopping bag paper. Once I learned public language, it would never again be easy for me to hear intimate family voices. More and more of my day was spent hearing words. But that may only be a way of saying that the day I raised my hand in class and spoke loudly to an entire room full of faces, my childhood started to end.
3. I grew up victim to a disabling confusion. As I grew fluent in English, I no longer could speak Spanish with confidence. I continued to understand spoken Spanish, and in high school I learned how to read and write Spanish, but for many years I could not pronounce it. A powerful guilt blocked my spoken words. An essential glue was missing whenever I tried to connect words to form sentences. I would be unable to break a barrier of sound to speak freely. I would speak or try to speak Spanish, and I would manage to utter halting, hiccuping words that betrayed my unease. When relatives and Spanish-speaking friends of my parents came to the house, my brother and sisters seemed reticent to use Spanish, but at least they managed to say a few necessary words before being excused. I never managed so gracefully. I was cursed with guilt. Each time I'd hear myself addressed in Spanish, I would be unable to respond with any success. I'd know the words I wanted to say, but I couldn't manage to say them. I would try to speak, but everything I said seemed to me horribly anglicized. My mouth would not form the words right. My jaw would tremble. After a phrase or two, I'd cough up a warm, silvery sound and stop. It surprised my listeners to hear me. They'd lower their heads, better to grasp what I was trying to say. They would repeat their questions in gentle, affectionate voices, but by then I would answer in English. "No, no," they would say, "we want you to speak to us in Spanish, en español." But I couldn't do it. Pocho, then, they called me. Sometimes playfully, teasingly, using the tender diminutive mi pochito. Sometimes not so playfully, mockingly, pocho. A Spanish dictionary defines that word as an adjective meaning colorless or bland. But I heard it as a noun naming the Mexican-American who, in becoming an American, forgets his native society. Pocho. The lady in the Mexican food store muttered, shaking her head. I looked up to the counter where red and green peppers were strung like Christmas tree lights and saw the frowning face of the stranger. My mother laughed somewhere behind me. She said that her children didn't want to practice our Spanish after they started going to school.